real form.
But Sir Galahad and Sir Tristram were there, but the fact that he still troops on board Sir Galahad was not the way things should have been. But anyway, by any standards, the outcome was very tragic. But I think, you know, one's got to accept that when you're dealing in a complex situation like this, you must take chances. There was tremendous pressure to get the troops forward, which we did more or less successfully against tremendous odds, so we could keep the whole momentum of the battle going. There was tremendous political pressure that we should do so in the circumstances. I think we took calculated risks. We were also incidentally regularly reinforcing the northern flank through San Salvador, which is an inlet to the north of the island, and Sir Percival and I think Sir Bedivere by that time were running a shuttle of stores up there, and that worked quite successfully, and we managed to mount some air defences for them, mount some rapier around them while they were exposed. We had rapier batteries actually in Tristram and Sir Galahad, I can't remember exactly which, but they hadn't been deployed before this attack. But you have to take risks, and I think in the second these risks were very reasonable, and the fact that on the balance we were caught out less than the opposition and did succeed in maintaining the momentum, I'm afraid that's what it's all about. Where do we go from there? It became clear thereafter, of course, we were getting into the final battles, and again, it's not for me to go into them directly. We were very well briefed in supporting the various efforts now for the battles for the mountains and the closure on Port Stanley. It was fairly clear, I think, that we were going to sustain all this. One personal experience which is worth recording is that 4 days after the battle for Goose Green, I felt that things were quiet enough to be able to accompany one of Major Hector Gullen of the Paris and the Special Forces who'd been attached to our staff. He'd been present at the battle, and I went ashore with him for a day and walked the battlefield with him, which was actually, it seemed long after the event then, but of course it was only just after, and it was extremely interesting. I remained with the amphibious forces for many years after this off and on, and I went to a lot of trouble to try and understand how the infantrymen and other military arms thought, and this was a very important part of my education, and it was quite something to do, and to actually walk across the start line, as the soldiery will say, and go through the battlefield with Hector Gullen explaining where various things had happened. For instance, they got bogged down where H. Jones had made his initiative, which proved to be personally fatal to him, and actually up to Goose Green, where there were still Argentines returning. We had a tremendous problem with prisoners, for instance, and the logistics of taking the prisoners was not the least of my concerns. It led me, an interesting little aside, it led me to send our chaplain, Peter Hudson, to spend some days at Goose Green, because there was a lot to be done in the chaplain's business, and not least in doing what we could to bury a large number of Argentines who came to grief in the battle, many of whom were fairly seriously, extremely seriously knocked about, and it's an unpleasant business for him, which he conducted very gallantly. There was an ammunition dump explosion while he was there, which was quite a traumatic experience for him and others, because there were many Argentines in the vicinity. And he finally came back to me right at the end of the battle, right at the end of the affair. The final days of the thing, what are the worthwhile recommendations? Ships were always changing around in the anchorage. I remember we finally got assigned a Type 42 destroyer, HMS Exeter, to give us a medium range air defence from within the anchorage. There were various combinations of air defence units tried. And the story of the loss of the Coventry, which occurred just to the north of Falkland Sound, was quite an event. As it happened, we were as usual on the gun direction platform with Mike Clapp running things in the operations room. It became clear to him and Admiral Woodward out to the east that Coventry had been fatally hit, and without a moment's hesitation, Mike Clapp was gathering every helicopter we could lay our hands on, which it was a very calm day. Fortunately, we got out to the Coventry, it turned over within about 25 minutes. We managed to get 290-something of a ship's company of 300 out, which is a remarkable achievement in circumstances. With all the helicopters on the scene, we were very well placed, very good, rather fortunate to have a broadsword who was with Coventry to cope with the situation and achieve a major life-saving operation. The day that Galahad was hit following the night convoy exploit, which I described briefly, there was an attack going on in San Carlos, or just to in the Falkland Sound, where Plymouth, HMS Plymouth, the frigate, had exposed itself to do some bombardment of West Falkland, where there was an Argentine position that we wanted to get rid of. She was caught by the Argentine Air Force and quite seriously damaged. Very much the same series of attacks going on whilst the Galahad was being hit as a Tristram. And that same afternoon, one of my landing craft, which was one of the ones I had left in the vicinity of Bluff Cove, landing craft F4, Foxtrot 4, was fatally hit by a strike following the Galahad strike. With the death of six of my ship's company, four Royal Marines and two sailors in what was for us a very tragic incident. And they say the aircraft that did it, four, I think only one survived. The other three had been disposed of by Harriers within literally a minute or so of their attack on F4. But the Plymouth attack did distract us to a degree with the fate of the Galahad. But an enormous number of injured people that day were being dealt with. I had a lot of burns cases from Galahad, both Chinese and from the Welsh Guards, brought on board. The most serious cases were taken to the field hospital Ajax Bay, just by us. And we dealt with people who had severe superficial burns, but were not otherwise so seriously injured. And a very pathetic but brave little group they made. Plymouth was very good at sorting out her problems herself. David Pentreath, the captain. There was an attack about this time, it wasn't that day, on Ajax Bay. Well, I'm darting around now, I'm not recollecting, but I was also on the bridge when two aircraft appeared unexpectedly from the east and coming over the hills in most unexpected direction attacked the logistic base we'd set up at the Ajax Bay sheep processing station, causing quite a lot of damage, setting ammunition on fire, quite a lot of local explosions, but also putting the field hospital in some hazard. And Rick Jolly is certainly someone who talked to with the medical officer in charge at Ajax Bay. Has some lurid stories to tell about all that. And another unexpected attack came from the south, from two Seahawks, Argentine naval Seahawks, Skyhawks, came from the south and took a direct pass at Fearless. One of them was already in serious trouble by the time it passed us. The bomb was missed. Slightly ahead of the ship. And one aircraft was literally breaking up as it passed over us, and indeed the pilot was ejecting, and a large piece of canopy landed on the wing of the bridge by one of the boat's mountings, which was proudly exhibited to me a moment later. And we looked astern, and there was something bobbing around, and this was where the pilot had actually bailed out. His parachute had just opened, and he landed in the water about 2 or 3 cables astern of us. So I sent a landing craft to pick him up, and we brought him on board. He was quite seriously injured in one knee, and what had happened was that when he pulled his hood, as he ejected, and the ejector seat sort of threw him up, his knee caught on the a bit of the canopy or the dash or something, so his knee was quite seriously dislocated, and he was in tremendous pain. But our medical staff and my doctor, and I went down to see the poor chap, and while this was going on, managed to get his knee back in all right. Spasm of agony, we got him fairly comfortable, and after that we looked after him, I think to his satisfaction. We looked after all the Argentines, just like we looked after our own people, as one would expect. Other particular recollections, they're vignettes really, But dashing back to day one, the Argonaut being hit off Fanning Head, I had a good view up towards Fanning Head, which from within the anchorage, and I saw three aircraft also descend on Argonaut, not very far offshore, which was completely enveloped in an explosion and a huge puff of smoke and spray. And I was very relieved when she gradually emerged from this, not looking very seriously different, although, as is known, she was quite badly damaged. She managed to stabilise her own situation, although without power, and she managed to anchor, and eventually she was towed in, and then I had her towed in by landing craft, an event well recounted in his book by Ewan Sykes, who told us to be brought into the heart of the anchorage. But she was able to use her weapon systems, and while we, amongst others, helped her patch herself up so she could eventually, under her own steam, go out to holding air and then be patched up when I wanted to go home. Her Captain Kit Lehman, who later liked me to return as a Royal Admiral. Other vignettes. One in particular, yes, all kinds of small scenes of aircraft dashing by. How we were never hit, I don't know, but we weren't seriously, except on one occasion when an aircraft went by and there was suddenly a great sort of kerfuffle and a sploosh of all kinds of bits and pieces and people hurt around me. I think this was probably, as I mentioned earlier, an own goal. I think probably someone fired a 4.5-inch shell, which was exploded by its proximity fused by the aircraft and sprayed lots of bits and pieces of shrapnel around fearless. I thought it was gunfire from the aircraft initially, but I think my explanation is probably correct. One man was seriously hurt on the upper deck of the gun's crews. A piece of large shrapnel passed between me and the chap next to me, knocking a large bit out of the binnacle of the compass next to us and hitting his finger a bit. But quite a lot of people had minor shrapnel wounds and the various holes here and there, which really illustrated the importance of the sandbagging. That was really the only direct damage we sustained, and apart from this one young man who had the muscles of the calf of one leg basically severed, otherwise no one sustained anything more than scratches. One of the final nights, almost, I think the last night before the surrender, recorded in David Brown's book on the naval aspect of the campaign, he being head of Naval Historical Branch. I recall seeing what turned out to be a Canberra being shot down by HMS Cardiff right over somewhere in the vicinity of the Stanley Air. I remember the thing sort of catching fire and coming down slowly like a sort of falling leaf. And yes, dashing back a day or so previously with HMS Extra in the anchorage, we had two reconnaissance aircraft came over in broad daylight. Absolutely crazy thing to do, and I will not forget from the upper deck hearing and watching Exeter fire two Sea Dart missiles, one of which hit the lead aircraft and destroyed it. But that's just a series of vignettes of the air defence battle, I'm afraid, in no sort of order, but perhaps not of less value from that. But finally it became clear that the battle for Stanley was in progress. One of the more colourful characters was then Colonel Mike Rose, now a general and commander of UK Land Forces. He ran his SAS operation to a degree from Fearless, and indeed they sat in porter cabins on the upper deck, which were in more normal times used for Mitchell's navigation classes. And they used to sit with their close communications direct to Whitehall, who had taken an objective view of the battle, sitting there watching through binoculars. He was by this time forward dealing with some of the negotiations. It leaves me with one anecdote I must tell, and that's with the BBC and their camera teams, who were with us for a certain stage of the early part of the battle before they went ashore. And they were terribly touched that I insisted they were all fitted up with tin hats and flak jackets, which were in short supply, as they danced around the upper deck with their cameras. This was Brian Hanrahan and his team, and very amusing and charming people they proved to be. But going on to the surrender, it became apparent with Mike Rose up in the forefront General Desmond Moore, who of course is said to serve as his headquarters, on his way forward from Queen Elizabeth. He'd come out of the 5th Infantry Brigade, taking up his forward headquarters in the field, but he wasn't with us. And of course, Brigadier Thompson and Brigadier Wilson, the 5th Infantry Brigade. The battle closed round Stanley, and on the final morning, when we were beginning to have to contemplate whether we were going to try and actually conduct a battle which would have meant street fighting in the town, it became clear that the Ardent Times were packing it in. I remember making one of my many periodic broadcasts the ship's captain, so passing on this information, and then a bit later saying that white flags had been observed in the vicinity at Port Stanley. And this must have been the 14th of June. The surrender, and I'm not the person to tell the story about that, at the Stanley end, was in due course activated or enacted. And very shortly afterwards, Fearless and a number of other ships left St. Carlos and went round to Port Stanley. The whole scene there was quite extraordinary. The end of a war or a battle always comes as a great surprise, and you're engaged in fighting the battle and not really very well prepared for what happens afterwards. And we didn't really have had time, any of us, to think through how we were going to manage things after the surrender. There were enormous problems, of course. The Argentines mainly gave up in a good grace. I think they had about enough, but there were large numbers of them to deal with. We established an enclave on the airfield where most of them foregathered, where we provided protection for them and an escort, as it were. It was decided that we'd bring the general in his enclave, that's General Menendez, who's commander of the Argentine forces, on board Fearless, where I was invited to look after him and see if I could also conduct some sort of interrogation. He was accompanied by some principal staff officers, I suppose his chief of staff, who was a brigadier general, another soldier, the head of the Air Force, and head of the Navy. The head of the Navy, I'm not quite sure. Anyway, it was a party of about five. So I found a part of the officers' quarters where we could settle them with some suitably impressive looking royal marine sentries at the end of the passage. And I established the general in the chaplain's cabin, the poor chaplain still being officiating in the field in quite unpleasant circumstances. Needless to say, he wasn't very cheerful when he came back on board and found General Menendez in his cabin. After a while, I thought that the generals are our own land commander's cabin. It was empty. I thought it would be a civilized thing to do, and in the best interest of all that we were attempting to achieve, to make General Menendez comfortable. So I moved him up into the general's quarters with the Commodore's approval. And there he had his rather lonely and forlorn headquarters for the time he was with us. It was a curious episode. He was working Spanish hours, which meant he got up. He was working by the sun, whereas I was working by the clock in the UK. So he got up at the moment of the time when a Spanish general might give up, and no doubt had his siesta in the afternoon, having done his morning business. And when evening arrived, the great social hour, that was the time for me to drop in and enjoy some of his whiskey, with which I thoughtfully provided him, and conduct what might pass for some conversation or even an interrogation. We had a remarkable marine called Rob Bell, who was half Costa Rican, who spoke Castellano, that's sort of Spanish, and with his assistance I was able to converse in more than purely social terms with the general, with his smattering of English and my smattering of Spanish. But with Rob Bell we could talk at some length, which we did, but I didn't think I was a very effective interrogator. I was quite sympathetic to the general situation. I was all for being civilized and restrained in what seemed to be a totally victorious situation. So I enjoyed whiskey, and what the record will probably show to have been some rather inconsequential conversations. Eventually, a more professional team came out to look after him. Actually, a very mild soldier who I know quite well. who was in Tiva, in charge of a Tivan bishop called St. Edmund, where the general's party was to be removed. But I didn't think actually in the event he was any first as I was. Well, what are my recollections of Stanley ashore? Well, many people can tell you about this, and I wasn't there right at the beginning. I mean, Max Hastings prides himself as being first into the town. I had my second weapons electrical officer, who was also an aviator. I had lots of amateur aviators who helped the pilots by flying about the left-hand seats in the helicopters to help them make the best of their hours in the sky. And he was one of those. He was also a good amateur cameraman. One of the great tragedies is that he made masses and masses of source video, all of which, so far as I'm aware, has got lost, but he was very early in standing, going along the streets in the Land Rover, just photographing out of the back. And of course we lent this stuff to various broadcasting authorities who promptly lost it or otherwise disposed of it, which was historically very sad. But the place was a terrible mess. The population had been well treated, more or less left alone. But there were various enclaves where the Argentines had made themselves at home. And one of the most impressive features of the place, I suppose, was being used as an enormous communal laboratory. And there was excrement absolutely everywhere. Under the pier in the corner, frightful. An awful lot of junk around the place, a certain amount of damage to the town, but not very much. But lots of abandoned vehicles and general sort of mess. It did behave very well, as a matter of fact. This was typical. I mean, by the standards of the treatise of the retreating army, a defeated army, it was pretty mild, really. It was a time to move around and look at things. I visited Goose Green a couple of times. They're very charming, they were, but they were also, I mean, one was greeted on one's first visit ecstatically, one's second visit, one bought sort of stores and I'd arranged for bread to be made for them and so on, and a few comforts of life. They'd run out of laboratory paper and sanitary towels and sort of obscure things that people run out in these circumstances, but we managed to obtain this sort of thing. But the second time one visited, they were pleased to see you. About the third time, it was quite clear the whole thing, it was getting rather tedious for them. So by that time, the Kirk of Italian was garrisoning Goose Green, and visiting troops were always tossing. Either spend his day on the Gurkhas were very fine, and he had his, I hardly say, very correct. Early visits to Government House. The gentleman ended that looked after Government House with almost loving care. I mean, even the ornaments were left in their places. But once three commanding brigade got in and started using it as a headquarters, I think it suffered considerably. And I think it's fair to say that perhaps the British were less careful with Port Stanley than had been the Argentines in a curious sort of way. I won't say the forces ran amok, but there was considerable euphoria when the battle was over, and I think in the early days some of the there was our control over our own people was not as good as it might have been. I won't say there was rape and pillage, but I think there was a great deal of acquisition of war material, and for instance, Mercedes jeeps, if that's what they're called, were hot property. And there was a generally acquisitive approach to liberating Argentine equipment. That sort of thing. But others can tell that sort of story at first hand. I was on the sides of it as we attempted, from a command point of view, to establish an administration in which I was being more concerned with maritime matter than I was, of course. I was present at a lot of these meetings, but not a prime mover, not my prime business. I visited the airfield in fairly colourful circumstances with my friend Mike Harris, captain of Cardiff. We had a helicopter, he dropped in one day, and he said, "Oh, Jeremy, why don't we go and have a look at the airfield and tell us all and look around the island and see what's going on?" So I acceded to this, and we landed on the airfield. And of course, it was absolutely packed with Argentines. So as we were getting out of the aircraft, someone said, oh sir, to my carriage, would you like a sidearm? So he all briskly collected some kind of first little revolver and was given some fairly rudimentary instruction in its use. And there we were, walking around the street with someone else, I can't remember who it was, but wandering around this airfield, magpies everywhere. So looking at Australia in a rather friendly way, I think they rather enjoyed the way the British treated them. They were sort of draped along by the NCOs, who treated them a very great deal better than their own NCOs. And although there wasn't much language in common, I think there was an instant sort of rapport, really. They were looking rather sort of smiley and pleased to see us. But it occurred to me afterwards it wasn't even an extremely sensible activity for two senior officers without any form of protection whatsoever. There was an interesting sight to be seen. There was an old gun on the side of the airfield, which was one of the part of the secondary armour of the Connecticut from the original Falklands campaign in 1914. A very interesting placement, just was the whole air of the gun emplacement had been used as a lavatory again. So you had to really watch where you walk. And of course, there was a serious problem because the Argentines mined the area extensively, and even to this day, it was a mining problem 10 years later, but we were very careful where we went then. But that's just a little sort of small vignette of the sort of curious circumstances that pertained. One found oneself in around government highest headquarters at various stages. I remember the church service of Thanksgiving, which was a very moving experience. But in the aftermath of what we were going to do, maintaining the SAS factory, the military profile and that sort of thing, I was rather looking forward to what my ship might be required to do next. And we had, of course, our frontline NATO duties, and I was very anxious if we were going to fulfil our commitments for exercising during the autumn, which lay ahead of us. I wanted to get the ship home and back on task, as it were, and I wanted time to give everyone time off before we got back, when we got back, so I suggested that perhaps Intrepid, who didn't have this sort of program to fulfill, could perhaps take over the lead from the amphibious side. And anyway, the Commodore moved ashore for the headquarters alongside the General and the Brigadier. We were rapidly moving into what we were going to do now. It was very clear that while we took elementary precautions, the islands were secure. And it was indeed agreed that Fearless could leave for home. So only about a week after surrender, we were withdrawing our forms, as it were, embarking the various elements of the forces that seemed appropriate, like needing all the particular helicopters. And very much so far as possible, the Canberra was reloading with the core of three commando brigade. As far as possible, I reloaded with the people who come down with us. So we'd go home in the same configuration as we went back. And so we left the Falklands. I don't remember an enormous amount about the journey home, except it was very much a period of collecting ourselves, enjoying what we'd been through, but we were all extremely tired. It was pleasant. It passed very quickly, and somehow it was satisfactory. There was a kind of recovery, personal recovery, communal recovery operation, and yet it had that feeling of unease associated with, as it were, a term coming to an end. We built very close relationships. It was an amazingly intense experience, which really from door to door in Portsmouth, it was 100 days or thereabouts. And one was very aware that all this needed to come to an end, it had to come to an end.